Welcome one, welcome all to the Snail Trail 4x4 podcast. If you like going off-roading in Toyotas, wrenching on Toyotas, camping in Toyotas, and maybe even poking a little bit of fun at Toyotas, and of course, did we forget to mention camping in Toyotas, then maybe this is the podcast for you. That's right, ladies and germs, my name is Tyler. Joining me once again for another awesome Thursday episode of the Snail Trail 4x4 is Mr. Jimmy Jett. Mr. Jett, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. Yep. Thank you for asking. Yourself?
Yeah. Doing pretty good.
Good.
I'm excited for this episode.
Dude, this is a much needed episode during this time right now. There's so much going on, and it's going to bring some good clarity, I think.
I hope so too. I don't even know if I want to talk a little bit about it. It went on for a while. We already recorded with him. We're sitting down to do the intro afterwards here. There's some things, there's some really big key points and key takeaways with this episode. It's not going to be our normal Thursday episode because we thought that there was a little bit of timeliness here and we wanted to get this one out and done. We're skipping kind of what we've been up to, and we're getting a very paramount interview in here for today. So there's a lot of stuff going on around the country right now in terms of outdoor recreation and vehicular recreation. And so we tracked down an individual who's more than happy to come on and help school us on vehicular recreation and access.
Absolutely. Before we jump into this episode, though, we should say that our normal Thursday content will probably come out next Thursday.
Yep.
We also have the Devos light giveaway. We don't have the numbers in from Patreon yet, so that will happen on next Thursday as well. Mm-hmm. And this month is open signups for the next gift box, which is Jim's month's gift box, which happens a month before Jim's month. But I get to claim 2 months, apparently, which I'm even more happy about. Yes, which means Tyler needs to get me now 8 presents next year. And I will probably have one of your presents for Tyler's mom.
I was going to say, technically, today's my birthday.
When this episode is released. Yes. Yeah. Yep. And I might have, since we're doing so many recordings, getting ready for us being gone at Cruise Moab, we're recording on Thursday also. And I might have your gift in by then.
Oh, okay.
I got you one gift, something similar, kind of a similar theme or a similar plan as which you did for Jim's month this year. So I got you one big gift.
That's exciting.
So if it shows up soon enough on Thursday, I might have it in time.
Is it pants?
No.
Oh, I really need some pants. We talked about this earlier.
Yeah, I did not get that's something the lady in your life should cover for you.
You don't want to measure my jock size?
No.
Okay.
Right, but whatever. I just, in regards to pants.
Oh, here we go.
I've been trying to get new work pants for a long time. And I finally, I wore a nice pair of pants to the shop and got them dirty on semi-purpose. And I can say this because the assistant doesn't listen to this podcast. Because my old work pants, like the crotch had a hole in it.
That was not a hole. That was a door, Jimmy.
It was. My above the pocket, one of my rear pockets had a huge hole on it. It was a holy pair of pants.
Understatement.
Right. Uh-huh. And so I wore a nice pair of pants to the shop and I did accidentally get power steering fluid on them, but now they're stained. So now I have a new pair of work pants.
What does everybody else out there use for shop garage clothing? Like, yeah, is there something out there that cleans really well? Because we haven't found it yet.
No, we just destroy clothing. Yes. That's what we do. But all right. So anyways, I think all of our necessity items, our housekeeping items have gone over. Mm-hmm. I do want to say that a lot of things were discussed in this episode and we took notes. And some of the key items that we have discussed are in the show notes. So if you want to help and support in any way, check out the show notes and you can go from there.
I like it. So without further ado, we have Ben in the virtual studio today from Blue Ribbon Coalition. So we've been wanting to get Ben on the podcast or the show for a while to talk about some stuff that Blue Ribbon Coalition is doing and that they're involved with. And one episode that we really wanted to do with Ben, essentially Wheeling Wine and Whiskey did a fantastic episode with them. We aired it over on our channel, episode 335. I would highly suggest before listening to this episode, go back, listen to that one. If you haven't already listened to it before, you don't know who Ben is. They did a good job of kind of introducing Ben. Whereas on this episode today, we just kind of jump right into it with him. Yeah. So if you want to learn more about Ben personally and a little bit, we get into a little bit about what Blue Ribbon does, but I think he goes into really good detail about Blue Ribbon and really what their goals and focuses are there on that episode 335. And then come back and listen to this one. There's some really, really good topics and some really good action items that we really need everybody's help with after listening to this episode. Yeah.
And some action items that need action fairly soon. Mm-hmm. I think one of them ends this upcoming Sunday,
which is a big one I've never even heard about before.
Neither have I. And that's, so we got links to all those once again in the show notes. So mm-hmm. check those out, listen to the episode, check, figure out what you want to help support. Hopefully it's everything, and check out the show notes and use the links below.
Cool. I like it. So without further ado, go ahead and grab your favorite drinks, grab your snacks, and let's sit on down with Ben and hear about some of the fun things going on around the country, shall we?
Let's do it.
Are you tired of landing in potholes and bouncing off obstacles? To play at your full potential, correctly tuned coilovers allow you to float over the rocks and gain more traction. At Four Wheel Underground, our full suspension systems include custom-tuned coilovers for your specific application. To learn more, visit fourwheelunderground.com.
Oh, welcome back, ladies and gentle ladies, to today's campfire discussion. We have another fun, literally a discussion that everybody I think should be having around the campfires. We have a trail issue come up recently, and we have a just about as good of an expert as any as we could get to help shed some light as to what's going on over here. So today we have here Ben from Blue Ribbon Coalition. Ben, how are you doing today, man?
I'm doing good. How are you?
We're doing pretty well. You know, I definitely got a little fired up. I tend to get a little fired up whenever trail advocacy issues come up. And so this one was kind of brought to us and originally made attention to us from our listeners. And the listeners are like, hey, did you guys hear what's going on? Did you see this? What's happening over here? And we had to do a little bit of research, and we're just kind of blown away as to the proposed terms of what's going on. So we're talking, of course, about Sand Mountain over in near Hurricane St. George, Sand Hollow area in southern Utah. There's a reservoir trying to get going, but they're trying to do a land swap and all this other stuff. And I know that things are changing very rapidly because we're in the very early stages of this. And that's why I wanted to get you on the podcast here to talk about what's happening. Where did all this start at? What was the genesis of it? Why is it happening? And is it a good thing, bad thing? Should off-roaders be concerned? If we should be, what are some things that we should be looking to do?
Yeah.
And take action for it? So what is this whole scenario over right now?
Yeah, so over by Sand Mountain and Sand Hollow in St. George, you have an area that's kind of this little valley. It's called either Long Valley, Warner Valley. You hear it thrown around, but it's this little valley where you can get off on a road there, and it kind of runs along the western base of Sand Mountain. And there are quite a few trails there. I drove by there the other weekend. We're in spring weather now in St. George area. And there were probably dozens, if not hundreds, of RVs camped out in there. This is a place where there's free, open, dispersed camping. And they're all base camping there to get into the trail system at Sand Hollow and Sand Mountain. Washington County has for years been exploring the possibility of building a reservoir out here. They have the Sand Hollow Reservoir, and then north of that, they have Quail Creek Reservoir. And so St. George is a very quickly growing community. They want to make sure they have enough water sources there to make sure they can sustain all the people. And so the plan for the reservoir has been around for a while. I think most folks in the off-road community that have been involved in this issue recognize that that reservoir, to the extent they get all the approvals and everything built, there's a lot of public will to get that done. And so I predict in some way, shape, or form, there will be a reservoir in the bottom of that valley at some point. This proposal is what kind of raised the alarm to everybody that the devil's really in the details there. Mm-hmm. The reservoir will cause there to be a loss of a few trails in this area and certainly some of the dispersed campsites. What alarmed us was when we got some of the original plans that they've put in part of what we call the scoping period, where they're really just feeling out the communities in the area, the users, the stakeholders, to see what are the issues that are going to come up with a proposal like this. And everyone had gone in with some assumptions of what a map was going to look like in this area, where the reservoir would be. There's a certain amount of BLM land in the area. And the person that the group, the entity that actually wants to own that land is the Washington County Water Conservancy District. They're the ones who manage the reservoirs and make sure there's water for the people of Washington County. So that's where you get a land swap. They want to acquire the BLM land. The BLM looks at this, and there was a law passed in 2009, a public land bill for Washington County that created a desert tortoise preserve in a different part of the county, a very completely different part of the county. And within the tortoise preserve, you also had all these private property owners that had end holdings in the tortoise preserve. And once your private property gets put into a tortoise preserve, you can't build on it. You can't do anything. So you're sitting on land that you could probably go sell right now at $1.2 million an acre in Washington County. And it's essentially worthless because the tortoise people won't let you build anything there or develop it. And that law required the federal government to make these property owners whole at whatever the current market value is. And so that's where you're getting this incentive to do a trade of some kind. And so it became this complicated land trade of, we'll give some land to the Washington County Water Conservancy District. We'll take it from the BLM. The BLM will get to acquire this land over here in the Desert Tortoise Preserve. And so that's like the basic lay of the land of what's happening here. What caused a lot of people to get alarmed is you have entities that are private end holders that are getting, they're not going to get nothing out of this. They're not going to give up their valuable tortoise land. Mm-hmm. And so what do they want? And early on, nobody was being very clear on how the property owners were getting made whole, what was going to happen there. So you started getting the rumors going around that they're going to want to develop some portion of this into houses and that's problematic because one, you'll lose your trails. Two, you'll get a lot of people moving in. And if you turn into something like Moab, where you have people living directly adjacent to an off-road park, you get complaints about noise and dust and tourism and crowded. And so you really don't want houses going in next to your off-road park for all those reasons. Mm-hmm. You never know who will move in and then they'll act like they're more important than the visitors. And in a case like this, I think they're wrong. I think Sand Hollow brings so much economic value into Washington County that I think it is the one use of public land in Washington County that rivals or probably beats high-end real estate development.
Wow.
In the long term.
That much of an economy?
Yeah, I absolutely do. With the events that come into Sand Hollow, it'd be harder to make that claim in some of the more backcountry areas of the state. I still think those are incredibly valuable recreation areas and they need to be managed that way. But Sand Hollow is, they get the visitation levels of our biggest national parks and you get these big events that come in. You have because it's managed by the state, you get a looser regulatory environment. I mean, it's the state park is, and then the BLM had this designated as an open OHV area. And so it really is a massive engine of economic growth to the area. So they have to be careful about it.
How does Sand Hollow compare to Moab for the OHV recreation economy?
I think they're comparable. I think Moab's is bigger than Moab wants to admit. They want to pretend like they can make it all up with national park visitors and hikers and base jumpers and mountain bikers. And they do get a lot of that. I mean, they do. Mm-hmm. But to ignore the impact of the off-road community in Moab, I think, I mean, we saw what happened in this last year. They stopped promoting it through their tourism transit room tax dollars. The word kind of got out that Moab didn't want you to come, was sort of the impression a lot of off-roaders had. And their room bookings were down 30-40% when we talked to the hotel owners we know in that area. Wow. And a lot of the county commissioners, who at least two county commissioners and the county attorney in Moab, lost their elections because they had been the leaders pushing for this fight, this deterrence of the OHV community in Moab. And so I think the business community in Moab understands where their revenue comes from.
Okay.
And so I think Moab's in an interesting transition. I don't know. I think everybody assumes it's a lost cause politically. I don't think it is. I think there's work to do. I think the off-road community has to be very cautious, be very respectful, and like they need to be careful, but I do think that people understand that economic impact. And I think Sand Hollow is comparable. It really is. And so back to Sand Hollow, I mean, that's like the lay of the land. You have a private landowner, you have two government entities that want to exchange land. And early on, there was a lot of withholding of information. Since then, the OHV groups like us, Blue Ribbon Coalition, Utah Public Lands Alliance, Desert Roads and Trails Society, Trail Hero, Matt's Off-Road Recovery, I mean, we had a whole group of stakeholders that were constantly engaging with these government leaders. And so now I can say, here's how I perceive the situation. There was a portion of this land exchange that was put into the map. If you look at the maps that are out there, it's this green little rectangle on the eastern edge. And it's where you have an intersection of like several major trails. It's where a bathroom's been installed. That part wasn't originally included in some of the earlier maps we had seen. Once that got thrown in, that's what caused everybody's alarm bells to go off, because that's the land you potentially could develop into high-end real estate. It was going to impact several high-value trails. Where the reservoir is will still cause an impact, but dispersed camping, you can offset that into new areas. As long as those who want to build the reservoir recognize the importance of that and designate a new area for that kind of activity, that kind of thing can be managed. But these trails were, everybody was like, no, that's like a major junction to some of the important West Rim trails in that area. Turns out the BLM claims that was just surveying efficiency. They didn't want to go resurvey the land. And so that was where an existing line was on their cadastral markers and surveys. And that's why they threw it in there. And that's what they're saying. I don't know to what extent I believe it, but that's what they're saying now.
Yeah.
And so if it's just surveying, then that's just, you go pay a surveyor to go out and draw a new line that excludes that. Or you put some restrictive covenants or deed restrictions, something in place that ensures that that gets managed in perpetuity as a recreation area and that they don't open it up for development, which is what they continue to tell us they want to do. And so I think the risk of them developing houses in the core area of where all the recreation's happening in this trade has gone from medium to high, because we just didn't know what was going on, to it's pretty low right now. I don't think they'll build houses there. That being said, we're still going to get a change in management.
Okay.
We still don't know what that'll look like. We haven't seen the legal mechanism by which they'll ensure that this area gets left open. And I do think they'll build houses. There's a ridge, like a rock formation, a big geological formation that kind of separates this valley from the other side of what is Washington City. I think they'll build houses on the Washington City side of this ridge. They're already there. And I don't think anyone would care. There's not a lot of trails there. It's right next to one of the main connector highways. It's not the same high value recreation destination that the other side of the ridge is. And so I don't want to say there won't be houses built because of this exchange and what's going on. There probably will. They'll probably just be built in an area where most of us, it won't matter. And so that's where we are now. As OHV groups, we're trying to encourage them to put the right legal mechanisms in place that the portions of this that do have high value recreation interest are continued to be managed that way. But that's where my perception of this process gets a little wishy-washy. And so let me explain why. There exists an act. It's called the Recreation and Public Purposes Act. This act allows a government entity to acquire, not to trade, but to acquire BLM land as long as it's used for recreation purposes. They can acquire,
like
a city can acquire 6,400 acres a year. A county can acquire 6,400 acres a year. And within a state, the state total for acquisitions is 26,000 acres a year. So Utah and its political subdivisions could be acquiring up to 26,000 acres a year of BLM land for recreation reasons. Once you acquire land through this act, it's kind of initially done through a lease so that the entity can prove it's going to do what it says it's going to do. Once it's proven that, then they transfer title and they take ownership of it. And there's a reversion clause. If they ever stop managing it for the reasons they stated, then it reverts back to ownership to the BLM. So there's already built-in legal teeth in the Recreation and Public Purposes Act. And it is actually how we've gotten a lot of our reservoirs in Utah is through acquisition of BLM land and then turning them into reservoirs. So that would have been the simpler way to do this. Is that it wouldn't have completely eliminated the problems. But they seemed insistent that this also solved their problem of needing to make whole these landowners out of the desert tortoise preserve. And that's why this became a complicated land trade. And what we understand now is that the owners of those private inholdings are going to be paid cash money to buy out their inholdings.
Gotcha. Rather than future property in the land swap.
That's the claim. I have yet to see that really clarified in writing. I don't know how much money they're getting paid. I live in Washington County, so that means my taxes are probably going to have to go pay to buy out a private landowner. Like, that should be the federal government's bill to pay. I didn't put their land, Washington County didn't put their land in a tortoise preserve. Congress did that. That was a taking by the federal government. The taxpayers of the United of America should pay to make these property owners whole, not the taxpayers of Washington County.
That's a good point.
So I like, just on a general broader level of what's good government, how should the American government system work? I think this is terrible government. I think if you're going to put people's properties into tortoise preserves, you better pay up. You better be able to pay that bill. And that was done in 2009. And the American taxpayers keep pulling out their empty pockets saying, we don't know where that money's going to come from. And now they've got some deal where they think they've got the county. What they're telling Washington County taxpayers is, you guys are getting a good deal out of this. You're getting land that you can turn into a reservoir, and that's worth your taxes. And I think they've complicated that equation. I don't believe it. And the other thing I don't love about the idea of this being a trade is, if you've seen the numbers, we're getting 89 acres of tortoise land out of this. We're giving up over 1,000 acres of high-value recreation land to get 89 acres of tortoise land.
That's so crazy.
And so how that valuation is working doesn't make sense to me, because on the other side of the state, we have the Bears Ears National Monument. And the Bears Ears National Monument also has private property inholdings and hundreds of thousands of acres of state inholdings from our trust lands, which are supposed to fund our school system. They're telling our state trust lands, those lands are worthless because they're only there for conservation reasons. I mean, we've been told for years that Bears Ears is some of the most precious stuff on earth. You've got all these cultural artifacts. There's all these natural things going on there. I mean, our organization is actually suing the Biden administration that was an abuse of the Antiquities Act, what they did there. But their claim is that it's so valuable as conservation land that they had to set aside 2 million acres to make it into a national monument.
Wow.
But then when CITLA comes to the table, our institutional trust lands, and says, okay, well, our trust lands are now landlocked inside this monument. They're like, yeah, well, that's just conservation land. It's essentially worthless.
Jeez.
But when we're doing this trade in Washington County, conservation land's 10 times more valuable than even this land could be prime real estate land. It is selling for $1.2 million an acre. If we didn't want it to be an OHV park or a reservoir, you could turn it into housing lots at $1.2 million an acre.
Wow.
So for them to tell us that the conservation land is is 10 times more valuable than everything else over in Washington County, where land sells at a premium. But in the monument, it's worthless. I think Sitla's getting ripped off. I think this is setting a terrible precedent for us to assume that these, that conservation use of a land is this inherently valuable. I think we're opening a can of worms. And if you look at some other things that are, so the Biden administration just last week released a rule called the Public Lands Rule. They want to update FLIPMA, which is like the operating system for our public land system. It's the Federal Land Policy Management Act.
Okay.
It's what allows for grazing permits and mining claim filings. It's what determines recreation, and it also determines how they manage for conservation and protection of resources. They want to update that to allow well-funded conservation organizations to buy essentially what they would call a conservation lease on public land. So they want to sell public land to the highest bidder, to those who will come and manage it for conservation purposes. So instead of being out there with a cattle rancher where you might have to just close some fences and gates and leave his cows alone, now you're having to determine management decisions with someone like the Nature Conservancy or the Sierra Club, who is now a funded partner to the BLM, dictating how everything will get managed.
Is there any way to do that from a recreational side?
I think that if the courts uphold what the BLM just is announcing they're starting to do, I mean, we're starting the public comment on that process just now for 90 days.
Okay.
If it will work for conservation, I think you could make the claim that they should do the same thing for recreation. I've been in talks with friends of mine who work in Congress about doing more to establish recreation use as a use that's based in actual rights and not just permissions from local management agencies. And there's some interesting discussions happening there. I think if they do this for conservation, then we'll have a strong legal precedent to say they should do it for recreation. You'd probably have to work that through a different administration in Washington. I don't know that the Biden crowd would do it. But if FLIPMA is that broad, and that's the question, is can an agency like the Department of Interior, the Bureau of Land Management, take this act that's been on the books since 1976 and say, we found all this new stuff in there that we can do that we weren't doing already? And 5 years ago, you'd probably get away with that. With the current Supreme Court, I don't know that you get away with it. But they're going to try. They'll say, I mean, they're the government. They have endless lawyers on payroll. They can at least try these things to see how far they get. And that's currently what they're doing.
Wow. A while ago, you mentioned that the county can take over a chunk of land to turn it into a recreation. How does taking a chunk of land to turn it into a reservoir deem it as recreation?
Well, because most reservoirs are then managed for recreation as well as water storage. And so every reservoir in the state of Utah allows for motorized water sports and watercraft, fishing. But usually they'll have all kinds of campsites and pavilions and picnic areas. And like usually reservoirs become recreation destination areas in a hot state like Utah. I mean, that's part of why Sand Hollow is such an economic juggernaut, is it isn't just the off-roading. It's off-roading combined with the county's largest reservoir. You get all the boaters come out. Tons of camping happens around the area. And so it will be a recreation destination. It'll change from being what is right now, heavy dispersed camping and off-road recreation, to a mix of all of the above. I don't think it'll displace it. I think they will, if they build the reservoir, I think with the clout we have as a community, we will get them to designate and set aside other areas for that dispersed camping activity. They'll either reroute or they won't close certain trails, is what we think we can get them to agree to. I mean, of course, we have to see all of this in substantive written agreements, but that's what we're fighting for right now. And they're open to it. I think Utah's a good state for this. The politicians tend to be pretty favorable towards outdoor recreation and especially motorized recreation. They seem to embrace all of it. At a state level and a local level. This one's just got messy because of the details. And I think as long as it becomes clear that the property owners are being bought out with cash and there's no land swapping that's going to open the door to some sort of private development or zoning changes from within the city. That's another question, is we don't know who will manage this when it's all said and done. It could be state parks. It could be the city. It could be the county. It probably won't be the BLM. Those are the details that probably get worked out through the forthcoming process that we'll have to all go through.
Will it make an appreciable difference as to who the land managing agency ends up being? Or is every, or for the most part, the land managing agencies in Utah all pretty pro OHV recreation?
It will make a difference. Let me just put it that way. Mm-hmm. All things being equal, Utah state parks tend to have a lighter regulatory touch than any of your federal agencies would, especially if it's becoming a cash cow, like money kind of talks to the state parks.
Okay.
The BLM in this area tends to be a good BLM office so far. The BLM is a national creature with local mm-hmm. appendages. Sometimes your local office is great to work with. Sometimes a field manager moves on or gets promoted or things change all the time in these offices. The people that are in the decision-making positions mm-hmm. are climbing a career ladder. That involves them moving around to different offices all the time. And so whatever your really good situation at the BLM might be today, that could turn into a nightmare tomorrow, depending on changes in political administrations. Whoever's winning, like Moab used to be great, and then they lost every seat of their local government for a period of time, and then it turned into a nightmare. And mm-hmm. so because these bureaucratic decision makers tend to be downstream of the rest of the political system, if the rest of the political system shifts, I have less confidence in the ability of the off-road community to influence the national BLM than I do in their ability to influence the county commission of Washington County.
Gotcha. Obviously, you always have the potential to influence the government seats, whoever is there. Are there some strategies that local people can do in order to help influence, say a seat turns over, somebody does move up the career ladder and somebody else comes in and who's like, has no clue about the history of what's going on and no clue about the juggernaut of OHV recreation in the area. How do you best influence those people to ensure that OHV continues?
Yeah, I think the best things that are happening now is you do end up with folks that aren't climbing the ladder. They're kind of your recreation managers, your range conservation specialists. These are just career BLM people. They don't want to be the decision makers. They just want a good, stable government job and something they're passionate about. And those tend to be the folks that go build relationships with local OHV clubs and go out and help them build the trailhead kiosks and the trail maintenance and the picking up the garbage and all those things that a lot of the OHV groups do. And those people tend to be a lot more stable. So if you have a strong relationship with your, and that's why we celebrate this kind of organic culture of Jeep clubs and OHV clubs and things that go out and build those relationships, that creates stability. I think in the local area here, the local elected people tend to be pretty sympathetic to it because the economic value is so strong. That can always change, but right now it feels pretty stable. In addition to that, there is a public comment period open right now until April 19th on this Sand Mountain thing. And so we have a link on our website. If you go to sharetrails.org, we have a section called updates. That's where all of our action alerts on. We have a form that if you fill out the form on our website, it goes straight to the BLM. We preload it with content you can use. I always recommend that people customize that. But it at least gives you some of the ideas of things we're concerned about. And so you're starting to, so it's an educational opportunity for us. But ultimately, the BLM values the most comments that are substantive and unique to yourself. And so an example here is I'm currently in litigation with the BLM in Utah in another area. It's called the San Rafael Desert. It wasn't a litigation we started. It was started by the wilderness groups, and it's been ongoing since at least 2008. And we've just been going back and forth and back and forth. And the most recent iteration of this, we filed an appeal of an administrative decision that came out this last year where they closed 120 miles of trails through a settlement with the wilderness groups, which we're opposed to. And I wrote my appeal and I basically said, look, these trails are valuable to the OHV community. We want to go use them. I included some of them in a guidebook we just released called The Lost Trails Guidebook. And that whole the whole purpose of that book was the reason they closed 120 miles of trails was they said they're not using these enough. It wasn't that we were going off trail. It wasn't that we were trashing the place. It's that people just aren't using them enough. There's plants growing back in the trail now. And if they were to go use it now, they'd be killing these plants. And just a dumb argument, like you just can't win because they just shift the goalposts every time you turn around. And so I'm like, well, we are using them. We put them in a guidebook. We went and inventoried the trail. It's a valuable trail. It goes to a cool place. People want to use it. And they said, well, you can't prove that people are using it. And I can. If you, if we really want to like go to court and have me call up as witnesses all of my members that are using this trail now, I can find them. I have who they are because they've made comments on our comment form. I can go see who's done it. I've taken survey. And so the most helpful thing you can do in your comment is actually just kind of testify that you actually use this area. You use this trail. You've used it. You have plans to go back. You want to use it again. You want to take your kids there. Like having that on the record is, if I had more of that, it would make our legal argument stronger, especially if it was coming from our BRC members using our form. I need that in every legal case I fight. And so if you're not adding in your personal experience of how you're using these trails, you're robbing the cause of something that's really important and you might not realize it.
That kind of leads into a question that I was going to ask a little later in the episode, but now's a great time to interject it is there are a lot of written the litigations or open comments going on right now for a bunch of different things around the country. Can you generically break down what somebody should write? Not verbatim, but maybe main topics. You just kind of hit on a few of those. Can you, like, what are they looking for or what do you want heard? How does somebody go about writing a good comment?
Yeah. So generally, like, if all you do is talk about your use of the area, that's probably 90% of what the average user brings to the table, that you do go to this area. You do use it. You identify the trails you want to use, the campsites that you camp in. Any of your use, you document it and just say, this is what I do there and I want to keep doing it. If you go back on a regular basis, if this is something you do every year or every couple months, let them know this is an ongoing thing and not a one-time thing. You have plans to go back. If you're there, a lot of times people like to pigeonhole off-roaders that we're just out there to go like crawl around on rocks and tear things up. We're every kind of user. I go out to camp. I go stand on the edge of cliffs and take pictures. I'm a photographer. I go out to spend time with my family. I like to take my dog out to go out and enjoy the outdoors too. Like, explain the value you get out of recreating on public land. If you are someone who uses motorized recreation, explain why motorized. So a lot of times that's because there's a disability involved. If that's the case, make the case. And if you want to go there, you could talk about your own economic impact. When I go, this is how I spend my money. This is the value I bring to the local community. If you're a business that is impacted, like if you were somebody that had like a rental business or a hotel or a gas station in this area, talking about how much of your business comes from this activity would be really helpful. A lot of times I find our business owners tend to be busy enough running their businesses that they don't get as involved in these things as they should. But our side also doesn't have a great coalition of scholars and economists and people that are studying this for them. We should, but we just have chosen not to invest in that very, I mean, there's some national things that do it, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, but as an industry, we don't really produce that data. We probably should. Like the DIRT, the camping app has done this. They've made their data available to scholars and academic institutions. So people are starting to study who's camping, when and where, what kind of people are these, matching it up with other data. And they're finding interesting things. They're finding that like the reservation systems that every public land agency wants to implement are actually mm-hmm. kind of discriminatory, both racially discriminatory, socioeconomically discriminatory. Mm-hmm. The reservation systems lead to camping areas that are used primarily by white upper class people. Mm-hmm. And that's going to become a huge problem for the agencies if they want to keep going down that path, because the government policy can't do that and they have the data that backs it up. And so we could be doing more of that, but the general public, that's probably not their job. It really, like, the industry should be investing in making that data available and usable for all of us. So that's like the basics of what I'm looking for from the general public to make a comment. Okay. In a case like this one, where like the land trade's going on, just telling them what you want the outcome to be. Our groups are going to come and make substantive asks of what we want legally out of this. Sometimes the public can take cues from that and back us up. And so they see that we're kind of coming with a large group of people asking for this and not just a few little manipulators of the system.
If you guys are going to be coming forward and trying to make legal
claims
to how we all want this to play out and kind of representing the off-road groups and doing this, what are some of those things that you're going to be looking to try and make sure happens?
Yeah. So that would be like a deed restriction or something that makes permanent the recreation access of, especially those trails on the east end where there was so much clouds of uncertainty of what was going to happen there. We want that codified into a code somewhere that says these will be managed as recreation amenities. We aren't going to close access to these trails. To the extent the reservoir maybe cuts off access to one of them down here, this is how we'll reroute it. And that and it would have to be something that has legal teeth in it, a deed restriction or reversion clause, something along those lines. And that would probably be the primary thing we look for. You get into the discussions with these governments, and a lot of times they're like, well, we're not far enough down the road yet to know what we want there. And you look at the BLM plan itself, and I have it right here. You get like this checklist, right? And this is all the stuff they're supposed to have figured out for this plan.
Oh, interesting.
They're supposed to be like dollar figures in each one of these boxes, and they have them in like three. So there's a lot of homework that still needs to get done. We're in scoping and they haven't given us like the full details of the plan. And So those are the things we'll be looking for, is who's going to pay for this? Is the money there? Is there legal teeth on the things they want to protect? And what are we actually going to lose? I'm not going to go out and tell people that we're not going to lose something here. I think they will get the reservoir. Like, and if you're from me, you're like, well, you're BRC. Why don't you sue them and block the reservoir? I don't think it's a smart lawsuit. I think if they don't get it administratively, I think they could get the Congress to authorize the reservoir. And if Congress authorizes it, then there's no lawsuit that's going to stop it.
And you get locked out of it altogether.
Yeah. And so I think we're in a better spot now to negotiate through the administrative process than to just dig in and litigate any potential outcome. But if they don't put in strong teeth to protect the trails that we know are there, that we've made they had a lot of people come to that meeting. I know they're getting hundreds, if not thousands, of comments. And
awesome.
So they know.
That's good.
And I don't think they want to aggravate the off-road community. I some of the political folks I talked to were kind of surprised, like, why are you guys so fired up about this? And I'm like, well, how are the private landowners being made whole? They're like, well, we don't know. I'm like, well, you've left a vacuum. Someone's going to fill it. Yeah. So give us the right information and we'll start communicating that and then working from there to educate the community. And I feel like they've started to do that a little better. There's still there's pages of tables of unanswered questions of if I was to read some of these, it's like, who's going to initiate Section 106 compliance? That's going and inventorying all the archaeological resources if they exist there. Mm. Those cost a lot of money to do those surveys. It's blank. Prepare and send tribal consultation letters. That's blank. It was supposed to be done by October of 22. draft a memorandum of understanding for review. That's done. I think that's what I have. It's not checked off here. Like, I just don't know why all these things are blank. Then you get down here and request for appraisal reports from the non-federal is $16,500. So, like, they're getting some pretty specific figures here. But then 40 of the 45 lines are blank. And so they have homework to do. I'll support people wanting to get things done, but they have to have done their homework. If they haven't done their homework, then all they've done is created a big vacuum. And that means the stakeholders are going to move in and fill that vacuum and rally political opposition to a thing. This is the mess that they've created, and we'll try to help them create a good outcome. But it's at this point, it's kind of a mess, but everybody should make clear what they want out of it.
That's fair. Because that's my big concern. I know that with as soon as you open up the kind of the Pandora's box or the can of worms towards an area with so many unanswered questions, it's exactly what you said. Now, everybody has drawn attention to it, and anybody gets to put their fingers into it, try and make something happen for whatever agenda that they're trying to accomplish. And so that was kind of my big concern here is whose agenda is going to win over in this situation? Because when situations like this arise, generally the OHV community, their agenda is almost the last one that gets thought about or put into play.
I mean, the reason for that is because, and this is something I try to educate the community about, and it's hard to get this to sink in. We are right to recreate on this land is a permission. It's not a right. Like when BRC takes something to court, like if we were to challenge this decision, let's say they hurt us, they take a trail and we don't like it. We can't just go to court and say, hey, you closed our trail. We want our trail back. The court will be like, well, was the government authorized to do this? And the answer to that is, yeah, they can close a trail if they want. They have through 1,500 different tools. They can close one. And so what we have to prove is, well, did you follow the correct process? And when BRC's won cases in the past, it's usually just been that we've caught them on the process. They didn't follow the process correctly. And the win is to force them to redo the process again. It's not this like guaranteed court ordered mandate that a trail stays open. It's that you have to go do the process correctly. And so to have this industry that's like the outdoor recreation economy is 800 and some odd billion dollars large.
Billion. Wow.
800 billion, almost $1 trillion industry.
Wow.
And if you break down the top five segments of this industry by use, the number one is motorboats and fishing. Number two is RVs. But think about it. I mean, a boat costs, you go buy a new Mastercraft right now, it's $300,000. It's as much as a house. And so, and a motorhome's about as much as a house. number three is hunting, which includes a huge motorized component because that's who the original market was for like UTVs and side-by-sides and things. Number four is your ATV side-by-side motorcycles. Number five is snow sports, which includes skiing, snowboarding, cross-country skiing, and of course, snowmobiling. So the top five industries in the outdoor recreation economy all have a substantial motorized component. And any one of those five is bigger than all the rest of them put together.
Really?
And we don't have codified protection of our rights. How is it possible that we have an industry that's this big and so politically irrelevant? It's the biggest strategic mistake we've made of the last 30 years.
Wow.
And
how do we fix that though? I mean, that's crazily impressive.
You have to start recognizing when you buy one of these machines, when you go to Cabela's and you buy a shotgun, you just bought a political identity. You believe something about the Second Amendment when you purchase that firearm. You did. You might not have agreed to that when you bought it. You might not have been thinking about that when you bought it, but you did. When people go buy a side-by-side or a motorhome or a camper or a truck or a Jeep or a dirt bike, whatever, they think they're just buying a dirt bike or a Jeep or a camper or a side-by-side or a motorhome. You're not. You are buying a political identity. You're signing up for a political fight. One day you'll realize it. I hope you realize it sooner rather than later and start investing in that and protecting it like the firearm owners have done around the Second Amendment. If they were to just take that step and formally organize that into a political identity, we would be riding, we would become the center of gravity of the public land system. Everywhere would be like Sand Hollow, because we are the center of gravity there. They know it. All the leaders know how politically relevant we are to this discussion. That's why we're part of it. The fact that we're not treated that way everywhere is because we haven't, like Sand Hollow, it's organized. It's because you have all these events that happen there that creates organization. That's why I get so, like, when you see the BLM creating all these rules around events and making them so hard to just get together and assemble, your right to assembly as people, as Americans, and to speak and to teach each other things and to communicate together about shared common interests, to manage that, that you only get access to that on public land because you've went and got permission from the BLM to exercise what are really kind of like fundamental, basic constitutional rights. Like, one day we'll wake up to all of this because they're starting to take it away and you have to push back. And so it's, I think the events have a big role to play in it. The industry is really hesitant to get involved. If you go talk to the leader, the owners of these big manufacturing companies and the companies that manufacture all of the toys and the vehicles and the machines you go buy, they don't want to touch the political side of this. For like gun owners have realized, like the gun manufacturers realize they're on one side of a political fight. This group still thinks they're straddling the spectrum. And to some extent, they kind of are. And on the other side of that, none of them are in business if they become public enemy of the government. Polaris's biggest customer is the Department of Defense. And so that contract could get killed tomorrow by some senator that decides to kill it. And so they're not going to go pick fights with the political system. It's not in their business interest. It usually isn't. Usually it's not in your business interest to get involved in a political fight. So it is what it is. But the users have to, it has to be grassroots. It has to come from the users. And this is what's hard, is it's you go buy a $30,000 side-by-side because you're wanting to get away from politics, you're wanting to get away from culture wars, you're wanting to get away from church, you're wanting to get away from your job. Everything that's like an obligation and a burden and toxic, this is your escape from it. And I'm telling you that you've just bought a political identity that your escape is actually part of it. So I get why people naturally don't want to politicize their outdoor recreation and their vacations and their escape. I wish there wasn't well-funded, politically organized groups trying to take it away from you, but there are. And they will until you stand up and demand that it stop and demand that you actually have a right to be there that's codified into law.
Well, and this is where Blue Ribbon Coalition comes in, right? This is where, you know, we have an organization that is starting to stand up for the people, no matter what group you're in, whether it's I don't know to the extent I'm in the off-roading political scene, as you're, you know, we're stating it here, but my understanding of Blue Ribbon Coalition is you guys cover all different types of outdoor rec. It's just not strictly off-roading. And so can you tell us a little bit about Blue Ribbon Coalition for those people that maybe haven't heard it before, and what you guys are doing for the battles that you guys are fighting and for who?
Yeah, so we've been around since 1987, and we do try to represent all outdoor recreation groups. Our representation tends to concentrate around motorized recreation groups because they're the groups that tend to face the highest amount of scrutiny when it comes to public loss of public land access. That being said, those five industries I just mentioned, power sports, RVs, hunting, motorcycles, side-by-side, snowmobiles.
Yeah.
We are focused on all of those because I want to, like, I need the industry to see that all of the biggest industries we're relevant in. And so some of our biggest growth engines in the last year and a half have been the power sport, motorsport recreationists on the lakes, like Lake Mead, Lake Powell, these Western reservoirs that have had water management issues. We're in a lawsuit in the Stanislaus National Forest in California about loss of snowmobile access. We were one of the
snowmobiles.
We were one of the biggest organizations fighting to keep snowmobiles access on Yellowstone National Park. So we fought for the over snow vehicle industry hard in our years of existence. Lots and lots of advocacy for off-road use, ATV, motorcycle, side-by-side, Jeep, full-size. One of the biggest threats I see out there right now is they're closing down all the dispersed camping, the free, primitive, open, dispersed camping. If you're somebody who's getting really excited about overlanding and upgrading your rig so that you can go out and camp off the grid somewhere, that use is getting shut down as we speak. Everywhere I look, I've tried to mobilize that community to get involved in this, and they just seem to have a bucket over their head and they don't want to hear it. But and the other thing our community tends to do is just like point fingers at each other and say, oh, well, it's because people are leaving human waste all over and garbage and all this stuff. And I'm like, maybe that's happening in some places. I've inventoried thousands and thousands of miles of trails myself and campsites for these fights, these legal fights. I go do it to get on the ground research for my witness declarations and things I write. It is not as big a problem as everybody says it is, but we buy into it and the narrative divides us. What I consider to be the dispersed camping or vehicle-based dispersed camping, if that's a use you enjoy and that you're getting into this for, you are in the crosshairs big time. Like the Jeeps and the side-by-sides have been in the crosshairs so long, they know that. Like nobody's surprised when you go tell a Jeep or, hey, look, we got to fight to keep trails open. They're like, oh yeah, the trails, we got it. Like they kind of know what you're talking about. If you go, I've been up with like the van life people, the overlanders, you go to tell them about this and they're like, what are you talking about? I didn't do anything wrong. And a lot of them don't. A lot of them, it's like a badge of honor to do leave no trace and go camp somewhere and you don't even know they were there. Mm-hmm. That's the group that's getting punished the most. To the extent, like Moab right now is doing a camping plan. They're wanting to take that whole area of Labyrinth Rim and Gemini Bridges, which is some of the best off-roading, beautiful campsites on the edge of cliffs overlooking the river. Like, and they want to take what is currently, you can go kind of camp whatever you want, just don't be an idiot. There's now going to be 350 sites. And if you're not in one of these sites, you get a citation. And the way they're choosing the sites is, do they already have a fire ring? Have they been hardened? Have people already been cutting down the branches and the trees in the area? So if you're somebody who went and left no trace, your experience is now closed. But if you're the person who went and trashed the place and left evidence of your camping experience behind, those are now the new campsites.
Wow.
And so the incentives are super perverse. That crowd's not speaking up for what it wants. They're going to require you just like everybody's going to be required to have their dogs on a leash in the back country, which is just nuts to me. This is an area where a kid got drug out of a tent by a bear in the middle of the night. And they're telling you, you have to have your dog on a leash. Like there's this is like wild country. Like, yeah. Anyway, it's... So that group, we are really focused on the side-by-sides. We've been involved everywhere with those. There's a lot of issues that come along with the side-by-side community as a new user group that everyone's working through. And the dirt bike, the single track users, we've had a heavy contingent of those. So we've been working with all these groups for 30 plus years. We work through advocacy, which is what we're talking about today, making comments, being involved in the process at all steps of the process. We want our members and our supporters and the communities involved in this. We fight through litigation. We've been in dozens of lawsuits fighting on the other side of mostly the wilderness and the environmental groups, challenging federal land agencies to keep these areas open to the public through lawsuits. And we've been successful at that. And we're currently in at least 5 major legal actions right now in Utah, California. We've done some appeals in Arizona, starting to see a lot of activity. We're helping a group in Idaho with some private landowner access issues that's blocking access to public land. And so we get involved in a range of things. Like that one's very local. We're challenging local ordinances in Moab. We think our national monument case is going to go to the Supreme Court. We think that's where that's headed. We've heard signals from the Supreme Court justices that they think the Antiquities Act is being abused. It won't be the first time that Blue Ribbon Coalition's fought one of these fights to the Supreme Court. And so I like to think that we're fighting it at all levels for all the user groups. We could only do it with support with our membership base. If you're a member of a club or an organization, they need to become members of BRC. That gives us representational standing for the legal fights we're in. And one of the issues that we're looking at currently, as will probably be our next legal action, we're doing due diligence on it, is film permitting requirements on public land.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, we've had some users. And the reason I want to talk about this is because we're curious, we're looking for anybody who's been affected by this. We've had users have land management, enforcement, law enforcement folks call them and say, you have to take down all your content. These are people who made put a GoPro wow. on their helmet. This isn't a film crew. This isn't a studio. But they put it on YouTube and they said, because you're putting your individually created content on a commercialized platform, that is commercial content. And so we now have regulatory authority over that. And some land management agencies are like cool about it. Like, whatever, we're not going to regulate 100 million Americans posting social media content. There are some agencies who are like, oh, we are absolutely going to do that. And so we see a lot of the national parks right now are updating their rules to where if you're in a group of more than five people, you have to have a film permit. My family, I have four kids. So if my family takes a picture at a national park, I technically could need a film permit for that.
Wow.
And I don't know that they'd like realistically enforce that, but I have people now that have been ordered to take down their content. And that's a First Amendment violation. It's been up in the air for the last 2 years because there was a guy back in Pennsylvania who challenged this in court who was making a documentary about Gettysburg. And his case went the right way early on in the court process, but then he lost on the Court of Appeals. And so there's questions about whether that Court of Appeals case was decided correctly and whether or not this isn't also a case that should be weighed in on by the Supreme Court about our First Amendment rights. And so I think we cover a wide range of issues that affect all recreation users. And our hope is that it doesn't lead to lawsuits. I don't think this Sand Mountain thing will be, I hope it doesn't lead to a lawsuit. I think that there's enough reasonable heads in the game that we'll all work out a deal. And now as better information comes out, it's going in a direction where I think there will be a resolution everyone can live with. But we're always preparing as if that might be where it goes.
Gotcha. Before we had started recording, you said that Sand Mountain is an issue going on right now, but you said that there were a couple other bigger, more important issues that you thought people should probably be aware of and know about what's going on. What are some of those issues going on around the country right now?
Yeah. So if I had to pick one, there's a rule out there right now for public comment called the greenhouse gas rule. Normally, federal agencies haven't had to analyze the impact of greenhouse gases on a decision. The Obama administration tried to put this in place. They did it at the last minute. When Trump came in, his administration, his people tossed this out. The Biden administration has brought it back, basically said it's in effect now. And so Sand Mountain, the worst iteration of this could end up closing five or six really important off-road trails. There's still a huge chunk of Sand Hollow that will be open for off-road recreation. In its worst iteration, it's still only affecting five or six trails. These are important trails. There are trails that get used in events. These are trails the community wants to keep open. We're going to fight for those. It's still five or six trails. In these cases I'm in with the wilderness folks in the other areas in Utah, and what will likely be what unfolds in Moab is we're talking about hundreds of miles of trails. Still a big fight. This greenhouse gas thing, depending on where they go with it, they have to analyze the greenhouse gas impact of a decision. And so if you're a public land manager and you're deciding whether to authorize a special use permit for an OHV event, or if you're deciding what trails to keep open and how much recreation is this going to bring into the area? What's the carbon emission impact of the people getting to this area, recreating in this area, getting home? They've never had to analyze that. And so if you use an internal combustion engine to recreate on public land, this could turn into a really heavy restriction where in order to do this, you're going to have to find, someone's going to have to find a way to mitigate or offset that. And we don't know how they'll implement this yet, but this is the kind of thing that it will affect everybody who uses a motor. And that to me is people who don't think it's them. hikers. Yeah. Nobody hikes from their doorstep to the national park. I mean, maybe you get like a Forrest Gump every now and then that does it. And it's like, they're like this public spectacle of a person that's like backpacking across the country. Mm-hmm. Everybody else gets there in a car.
Yeah.
Even if they're not off-roading. So all for outdoor recreation involves some sort of burning of fossil fuels in a either a combustion engine or whatever coal plants firing up your Tesla. Mm-hmm. Like you're using it somehow. So the fact that a power sport industry that's basically built off of internal combustion engines isn't looking at this greenhouse gas emission rule with a lot more scrutiny surprises me. I mean, we're engaging on it. We're trying to educate our members, but if I was to compare the number of comments coming in on Sand Hollow versus the greenhouse gas rule, it's 10 to 1 at best. Wow. And the greenhouse gas rule will affect everybody, all your recreation in every area over time. If it goes into effect as they're envisioning it, it'll lead to a restriction or a cost. And I don't know how it'll play out, but if you're not paying attention to it, one day you'll just wake up and be surprised.
That's astounding to me that Polaris is not looking at the greenhouse gas thing, that Mastercraft isn't looking at it, that RV manufacturers aren't looking at it. Like that's astounding that nobody is wanting to get involved when literally those top five entire industries are I don't want to say in jeopardy, but that's a big hit. Our
economy is so overregulated that you can't run one of those businesses without getting permission or tacit approval from the government 100,000 different times a day. Mm-hmm. And if you were to task me to just say, okay, Ben, go scrutinize Industry X and find them violating some federal regulation or law. Mm-hmm. In 2 weeks, every single company operating in the world probably has dozens or hundreds of violations a week. And so as soon as you start training the resources of the federal government and scrutinizing that, you're going to find a problem with anybody. Yeah. Even the most legally upright businesses, we've created such a mess, a web of regulation. Mm-hmm. Nobody can fully withstand it if it had the enforcement capacity that's built into it. And so I don't ever blame a company for just sticking to business. Mm-hmm. Because you open that can of worms and you don't know where it's going to go. Mm. And then you add to that, you have some of the highest levels of our economy. You have like the finance industry buying into these ESG, like environmental social governance rules. And so maybe you're managed the regulatory like booby trap, like fine. You still now have your bank won't lend you money if you're involved in one of these industries, unless you're playing ball. And so we've created a really toxic political system that I don't know how it plays out. It either ends up in revolts in the street, like what you're seeing in Europe, or you get I think you'll see a lot of election changes happen where more reasonable people are coming in and solving this. But right now we've just given so much deference to the executive branch of government to kind of make things up as they go. And you can't unelect them. That's the problem. That's my biggest problem with this greenhouse gas rule, is they couldn't get this done through Congress if they tried. Congress wouldn't vote for this right now, even divided as it is between the different parties. Like Joe Manchin would kill it. Like you just can't get it passed. And so the agency is like, well, we'll just make it up and see what we can see, how far we can go, like what the courts will allow us to get away with. And then we've essentially created new law. And our system of government is designed to where those who create laws should eventually stand before the voters. And so by having that administrative branch of government being the ones making the real rules, and then they're not politically accountable to the people, we've created a huge, huge mess that's way bigger than off-roading. It's everything.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And so until the people wake up to that and demand that Congress be the ones that passes these kinds of things, so that if you don't like it, you can vote them out. I worry we'll keep getting a lot more of this, and we still have the courts, and the Supreme Court is probably as good as you'll ever see in your lifetime on these issues of wanting to roll back the authority of the administrative state. But that's a different dance, and some things work really well for that. Some things still don't. Mm-hmm. And So the people have to take back their political branch of government, or we're going to just keep getting screwed.
So what can people do to fight this greenhouse gas event that's going on?
Open for public comment now until I believe April 9th or 10th. We have an action alert for this on the Blue Ribbon Coalition website, sharetrails.org. And so we've tried to share this. It just doesn't get the same viral traction as the Sand Hollow thing. So once you've found this on your own from us, I mean, it's not like we're hiding it from you. We sure could use some help sharing it and getting people engaged and starting to see that there's all these pieces that fit together. And if you're just focused on your trail or Moab or Sand Hollow or your little thing you care about, they're coming at you from 10 different directions. And if you're not looking at all of those, then you're still going to lose. And so that's the other value I think that Blue Ribbon Coalition brings, that there aren't a lot of organizations out there doing it with that same scope that we have to try to alert you to all the different ways they're trying to take away this thing that you love so much from you. But they are doing it. They're trying, and they're going to be, and they will succeed to the extent our community and our groups continue to ignore it or only focus on a few things every now and then.
Yeah.
But I think we'll succeed once the real army shows up behind us. I think there's a lot of good we're doing. We're laying a lot of good groundwork to become, I think, as big as any of the environmental groups that are on the other side of us on these issues. But I do need the community to show up and sign up and be part of it. We actually have like really good organic organization already. There's a lot of clubs and off-road groups and this thing that kind of happens naturally within our communities. And so I think we're 20, 30, 40% there sometimes, there's a lot more to do. And once we show up, yeah. I think we'll be changing laws at the federal level. Some of those I'm working on. One of the ones, so for example, just so you guys can kind of understand how this would work. Every group I go to nowadays, I meet and talk and present to a lot of clubs. There's always a cohort within this group of folks who have aged into a disability and where off-road recreation is like their lifeline to the outdoors. And motorized recreation is how they're able to get outside and still enjoy the outdoors and get out into these beautiful places where they want to go. And it is a huge value add to their life. And they can't hike out there anymore. They can't exert the physical activity they used to when they were younger. So there's this growing group of folks that see that there is an element of disability access to this. Blue Ribbon Coalition fought in court that when you close off-road areas and off-road trails to the general public, that you're creating a disability access problem and you're discriminating against those with disabilities. And the court basically said, no, as long as it's closed to everybody, we're not discriminating. And my answer to that is, well, it isn't closed to the able-bodied. Able-bodied people can still walk in and enjoy it.
They can walk in, exactly.
And they just don't see it that way. And so when I've talked to members of Congress, I'm like, well, what you should do is require a land manager when they're coming up with a plan for an area, like in Moab, for instance, this travel plan, that you have to have a certain route density, a certain number of routes within a defined geographic area. And if you don't have that level of route density, then your plan is discriminatory. And those with disabilities would have a cause of action to challenge that plan at court. That's an actual right of access. If they take away that access, you now have something you can sue in court, that the court outcome of that would be a mandate to the agency to open more trails in that area and to not prohibit access to that group. We just don't have anything like that currently. There's not a single law that gives us that much clout in court to require that things get left open or reopened.
Yeah,
it's all hardwired towards closure.
What about the argument that closing more trails makes the off-road user density of other trails higher, thus creating more damage and unsustainable damage to those areas?
That's an absolutely true thing that happens. It's a thing the court doesn't care about. I actually saw a legal update on that yesterday. I haven't dug into the filing, but it was about that specific issue in the court ruled as in that's up to the agency to decide. They're not going to get in the middle of it, essentially.
Interesting. Wow. All right.
I have I've got one more for you. I'm curious, and this is hypothetical to some extent. How would one go about organizing all of these motorsport entities and try and unite them?
Yeah, no, that's, I've heard a lot of groups talk about that since I've come in. The groups are kind of territorial, has been kind of the education I've gotten in this. And there's a lot of strong personalities in the community. So there's, there's headwinds there. And this is a movement that's been around since the 70s and 80s and still hasn't coalesced into something like a juggernaut. There's definitely been some groups that have done good work, and I don't want to undermine it because I know how hard this work is. And so to anybody who's been doing this in the last 20 or 30 years and had any amount of success, like, shout out to you, because you're the reason even someone like me is even willing to try, is because there have been people that have pulled it off. But there's a few things that I think have to happen. It has to be nationally focused. It has to be all the groups. It can't just be one user group or another. And if you're a Jeeper, I know you might not like the side-by-side group. I get it. Every group has a purity culture. If you're a mountain biker and you don't like e-bikes, I get it. But as long as that's the mindset, the dominant mindset, it's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. Those divisions, actually, I think they intentionally get, those wedges get driven just because it fragments the group. And so I think that there's people actually intentionally doing that to our group. So you've just got to let it go and unite around some of the common causes. I think what the other side has done well is they come up with legislation that's nationally mobilizing. At first, it feels like a long shot, but because it serves the common interest of everybody in the group, they've been very successful at getting a few big pieces of legislation passed that gives them a lot of legal teeth. And so I think you need national legislation that mobilizes the group. We tend to just, to the extent that this off-road community and the outdoor recreation community goes and lobbies nationally for things, it's usually just for money, for trails and grants and stuff, and just a seat at the trough. And that's fine. We need, like, all of this does need money to be maintained and managed. And the federal government all the trillions of dollars it spends, its pockets always seem to be empty. And so I don't blame them for that. But that, no, you're not going to build a national movement around expanding the RTP budget. It's got to be fighting for the actual rights and then the value of. And then the other thing we got to get beyond is that it's that this is about trails, or this is about areas, or this is about Jeeps or side-by-sides. It's not. It's about an experience that transcends all of those things. Why do we as people need this stuff? Is it really just dispensable? Is it really just someone's record? We run into this a lot with the lakes. Like, why should we care about water in a reservoir for water skiers? Good question, right? We need water to drink it. We need it to grow our food. There's a lot of other uses of water I can think of that isn't water skiing. And they actually have a really valid point. But I think we actually do need the water skiing. I think as people, we've gotten so addicted to technology, so addicted to modern comforts and modern amenities, and there's something missing in that whole modern equation. And that's why the outdoor recreation economy has exploded in a way that correlates with how connected we've also gotten to technology. And there's something there. It's mental health, it's physical health. In Canada, they've actually defined outdoor recreation as a health benefit that can be paid for. It can be prescribed and paid for through their national healthcare system.
I heard about that recently, yeah.
And if that's true, that this is a public health benefit at that level, you can't take it away from people. You have to make it available, and that's worth fighting for, to be a healthy society that has outlets for these things. And are there other important things too? Yeah. Like, should this be the only thing? No. And that's my answer to the water skiing thing, is we do need water. That's why we need reservoirs. And while the reservoir is a reservoir, it can also be used for recreation, which creates a ton of economic value and benefit and a lot of mental and physical health benefit for the person using it. We actually can have it all if we'll manage it well. And right now, that question of how do we manage it well is so tilted to one side of this, what I consider to be like the wilderness crowd that wants to close off access. There are powerful political movements that really just don't want any people anywhere other than densely populated areas and a few urban centers. And that's a vision of the world some people have. I disagree fundamentally with it. I think we should be building a powerful political system that opposes that. I think living in rural, remote areas has a lot of value there's costs to it. We should find ways to pay for those. Our economy has figured out how to absorb the cost of a lot of this stuff. But we've got to let it operate. We can't smother it under a web of regulation that's so impossible to comply with that no one dares start a business or no one dares advocate for better government because they're worried the government will get politicized and weaponized against them, which is where we are now. And so to the unity thing, I mean, my approach has been, I'm going to go fight for everybody that I can, as hard as I can. And at some point, that track record is going to speak for itself. And people unite behind leadership. They unite behind vision. They unite behind results. And I think we've gotten all of those things just in the few years I've been running BRC. And so now it's a matter of getting that story out there and creating more stories to tell. And that's, so I think we're on a path to becoming something like that. I don't think even if we succeed beyond my wildest dreams, I don't think even BRC will be enough. But I think we can help blaze the trail that gets a lot of us there, and other groups will come and compete and find ways of doing it their own way. And like the environmental movement that's gotten so strong, you had a few groups that became really big and nationally significant. It was like the Nature Conservancy, the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society, Audubon Society, like you, Natural Resource Defense Council, the Environmental Defense Fund. I mean, they're just some of the, and they're all just juggernauts. They're funded by, they'll never run out of money because they became like social branding causes for billionaires. Like there's, our side has all the ingredients to become that. We just have to decide to one day.
That's a lot. And it's some really, really good viewpoints and perspective. I think that needs to be brought to the table. You know, we're always harking about it here on the show, which I think is pretty cool that our listeners brought the whole issue of Sand Mountain to our attention. And so I hope that we can help unite and help share those stories, like you're saying, and help get people on the same page here. Because, God, if we could make outdoor recreation a mental health staple for the country, that alone, I think, A, needs to happen anyways, but B, that would be so massive for everybody in this country. So that'd be huge.
And if it is, and if it's seen as that, and not just as some sort of like leisure activity for somebody with some extra time, but an essential part of your well-being and your health, then you start to feel more entitled to having a right to it. And that's the mindset I think people need to adopt. There's certainly enough outdoor recreation opportunity out there for everybody to go find whatever it is that gives them that benefit.
Yeah.
And that's the other, that's one of the other big false narratives and myths, is that there is this, like, you get out, you guys have been out into, I don't care where you go, even a state as densely populated as California, you'd probably not have to travel too far to get out to where you're the only person out there and you can find your own thing. And so it's, people need to start seeing it that way, talking about it in those terms.
I like it. I think that's a great way to kind of wrap up the theme of this episode. So, man, it's been great having you on, Ben, getting to chat with you. We're definitely looking forward to having you on in the future and seeing what other things BRC is up to, seeing, updates on these different issues going around on around the country that threaten outdoor recreation. You know, we're big fans and advocates here on the podcast, and I know a lot of our listeners are too. So if people wanted to go and learn more about Blue Ribbon Coalition and see kind of what you guys do, or hopefully go and get a membership at Blue Ribbon Coalition, where and how can they go about doing that?
Yeah, so sharetrails.org is our website. We're also on all the social media channels. So Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. We're on Twitter and LinkedIn. We don't use them as much, but Facebook and Instagram is probably where we're the most active. But definitely go to sharetrails.org. That's where we have our action alerts, where you could comment on Sand Hollow. You could comment on this greenhouse gas thing. We always have probably five or six of these active at any given time. We have a map on our homepage that shows the issues we've engaged in by state and We've been, since we started that, we've done 28 states, I believe, over 300 actions. So if the Sand Hollow thing is an action, we've done over 300 in a year and a half. So if you don't think we're working in your area, I can assure you we probably are, especially in the Western United States. That's where the public land is concentrated. And so that's where most of our work is. But we've done a lot of work, surprisingly, in some of the southern and eastern Appalachian areas. So
I was going to say, what do you say to people that are on the East Coast that are like, well, we don't have public lands over here, so there's no point in me worrying about public lands?
They don't have as many public lands. They have them, though. And each, like what I've learned once you get back east is each state is its completely different animal. And some have better than others. National forest system really exists in most states. So you will find national forests back east. They tend to be a lot more regulated than our forests out west. But we've done camping and travel plans in Pennsylvania, Georgia, Alabama, West Virginia, Tennessee. We get a lot of snowmobile interest out of like Minnesota, Wisconsin. I mean, that's where all the big snowmobiling happens. It's very different than the West. They get out on trails and things. We're out in the West. You're doing the open country riding and deep snow up in the mountains. But we have a base of support there. So I think the water access issues are interesting. I mean, we got roped into it from the Lake Powell and the Lake Mead crowd having to deal with really low reservoir levels out in the West. But a lot of the same rules applied. There's a lot of reservoirs and lakes that have been managed throughout the whole country. I mean, our whole country is this massive hydrologic management system in some ways. And so I'm always interested, like, I always kind of like getting these like off the wall issues. Like we had this group of jet boat users in Oregon call us. These are like mini jet boats that people are building out of putting a wave runner engine in a custom fabricated little boat that you sit in, like two seats side by side, and they go shooting up these rapids in the rivers. And the Oregon State Marine Board wanted to regulate them and define them as personal watercraft, like, which is a wave runner, which isn't allowed. If you're sitting down in front of a wheel, that's a boat and that's allowed. And so the industry kind of innovated around the rule. And then the regulators were like, we got to catch up to this. And so to go learn how the Oregon State Marine Board works in Oregon, like, we figured it out. Like, a lot of times these processes are the same. It's just the players are different. The institutions are slightly different. And so far there hasn't been an outdoor recreation issue where there's been a problem that has been brought to us where we haven't been able to at least dig into it, find out how to make ourselves relevant and fight for a better outcome. And so BLM and federal land stuff out west tends to get pretty systematized. Like, it gets done a lot. But outdoor recreation is exploding everywhere. The same challenges come along with it everywhere you go. And it's just a different animal when you get into different parts of the country.
Cool, man. Yeah, I got nothing else for this episode here. I've been going on for a little bit, but I definitely think we want to have you back on the show in the future here to, again, raise the awareness, keep the awareness going, help share some of those stories. So thanks so much for taking time out of your day. I know you've got your hand in a lot of different stuff going on with BRC and helping fight for all of us outdoor recreationalists out there. So from at least Jimmy and I, huge, massive thank you for what you're doing. Hopefully, you know, we can do at least just a little part of bringing more people together. So
yeah, we appreciate being on the show and being a guest and helping us get the word out. That's what I've told you right now is probably our biggest challenge is just you do 300 actions a year. That's a lot of stories to tell. And most people's attention level for this stuff is pretty low to begin with. So anybody who wants to help us get the word out, we appreciate it. I'll come back anytime.
Awesome. Thanks, man. I like to do a fun part at the end of the show where I like to put everybody on the spot and with your final words you want to leave everybody with. So Jimmy's used to it. I'll have him go first. Jimmy, final words for everyone.
My final words are don't glaze over. We all hear this in the off-roading community that we got to concern ourselves with the trails and we got to do something, but we hear it every single day, but don't glaze over. Don't let it go away. We have to fight. We have to fight the good fight. And we have to do the things the right way. And we have to continue to do it to keep our trails.
I like it. Ben, final words for everybody out there.
If I have to fight for one more trail getting closed because people didn't use it enough, I'm going to quit. So don't glaze over, but go out and find a trail that's yours. Go find something that hasn't been explored. Go find it. Like, this doesn't have to be reading bureaucratic nonsense. We'll do that. But go find some cool trails. Like, go find cool stuff. That's the whole point of doing all of this. And don't put me in a position where I have to go defend a trail because the environmental groups say we don't use it enough. I'm not going to lose that one again.
I love it. Awesome, man. I guess without anything else to be said, remember, everybody out there, keep crawling.
I have a joke.
Do you really?
I do.
Okay.
Why don't you see dinosaurs at Easter?
I don't know.
Because they're extinct.
Okay. Their eggs stink?
Their eggs stink. How can you tell when a rabbit is getting old? You look for gray hairs.
That's a, truth.
How do you know when a rabbit is in a good mood?
I don't know.
He's hoppy.
Okay.
What did the magician say after the rabbit vanished?
I don't know. What did he say?
Here today, gone tomorrow.
No, you're done.
What do you call a transformer bunny?
I have no idea.
Hoppimus Prime.
Okay. Hoppopotamus.
Hoptimus.
Hoptimus Prime.
Hoptimus Prime.
Okay.
Optimus Prime.
Yeah, I get
Transformers.
It. Yeah, I know.
He's the semi guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Somebody save me.